Yes, we're out there, everyone, and welcome back to None But the Brave, a presentation of Evergreen Podcast. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy Flynn McClain. And Flynn, things are really starting to ramp up. We're 2 weeks from the start of the 2024 tour. Today, we got an announcement for an additional date, September 15th, on the beach in Asbury Park at Sea Here Now, which should be pretty cool. And we've also got an announcement for a new best of package from Mr. Springsteen.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band on the beach, Asbury Park, under the stars. Got a lot of potential to be really special. Now, on the other hand, the best of seems to be just another greatest hits kind of compilation, but it's not for us. It's for more casual fans, but they do seem to be kind of targeting the vinyl buying audience. I don't know how many casual fans are into the vinyl. And you also got to think that all of these songs are on streaming services, and that's how most people these days seem to get their music. So not really sure what kind of the point is.
Well, I think with the vinyl, the thing is, and I expect they're going to be utilizing these songs more moving forward. Someone hears Born to Run on a TV show or something, they go out and they buy a greatest hits package. So now there will be this new best of that's out there. The other thing is, and I've seen online, some people seem to be upset about this. You and I are really the poster children for Tracks 2. This release is not in place of Tracks 2. It has nothing to do with Tracks 2. Obviously, Tracks 2 would not be coming out in April. This really seems positioned for the European leg of the tour. As you say, casual fans, they hear a Born in the USA, they hear a Born to Run. Oh, what can I pick up on vinyl? Because a lot of the Gen Z, I think, is collecting vinyl. And maybe they make some new sales and some new fans. And that's great, because obviously we want Bruce to have new fans. And Sony has $550 million that they need to get back.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. I kind of doubt if Bruce Inc. had much to do with this, or at least they probably didn't have that much work to do on it. I'm sure Sony said, here are the songs we suggest. I'm sure Bruce and Landau said, okay, well, maybe take this one out, put this one in. But I can't imagine too much other work that they would have done. I mean, all this stuff is pretty much taking from previous releases. From what I know, it's not like they've remastered or remixed any of these.
No.
These are pretty much the same ones from what, 2014, and then whenever the album's Volume 2 was released, and of course I think the last since what, The Rising, I don't think there's been any kind of remastering of those or remixing.
No.
So it's what's interesting to me is that this is what, the fourth or fifth set of this kind of thing. And I remember back in 95, I guess it was, 95, when Greatest Hits came out. I was trying to think if discussion dated back to 94, but it did not. Where people were debating, what's a greatest hit? And, you know, should Bruce do it? But that, I think at that time, it was considered kind of a crass commercialization. And a lot of people were still very protective of Bruce in that way at that time. And obviously, since then, we've had multiples of these sets.
Well, really, to be fair, they can't win, because one of the things that you see people say is, well, why didn't they add some bonus tracks to this? But when they added bonus tracks to the other releases, people were like, what? We have to buy an entire release to get three or four songs? So they really can't win. And yeah. This release is clearly not intended for us. Are you going to buy it?
I am undecided at the moment. If I get it, it would be on vinyl just to have the big artwork. And I mean, it is a cool cover. We got to say that. And it sounds like they have some new packaging, obviously it's a new set. Some new pictures are going to be with it. Hopefully they will be previously unseen. And then Eric Flanagan wrote an essay for it. And so I do want to be able to read that. So I think for that reason alone, I will probably end up picking it up at some point.
Yeah, it's fantastic that they're using Eric for that. And of course, he will be spot on. And I'm probably going to buy it as well, for many of the same reasons, to read Eric's liner notes, but also to have it on vinyl. I'm surprised they're not doing something, because it is coming out April 19th. Again, my surprise that they're They don't seem to be doing anything with Record Store Day. Pearl Jam's new record, Dark Matter, is coming out April 19th, and they do have a Record Store Day tie-in. But this is something that was clearly going to be happening. And I'm actually a little surprised because early 2022 when he sold the catalog? I'm really surprised they haven't utilized the catalog more in this capacity. And also, it's a little surprising we haven't heard more commercial use. And I'm sure that's going to be ramped up because, as I said a couple of minutes ago, they have a lot of money to recoup.
Well, how would they get it? How would they get more music in commercials if nobody approaches them? If nobody's interested in using, say,
that's true.
You know, Dancing in the Dark, or again, I guess that was one of the first ones used, or maybe Nike wants to use Born to Run in their next commercial. They would have to actually have the idea and think it would work and then approach Sony. I don't know how you actively market this kind of music to
actually to ad creators? They probably do. If they want to put it out into the advertising world, they probably are actively marketing it. I do know, and this goes on every year at South by Southwest. This is different because the people are nowhere near on the scale of Bruce, of course, but up and coming artists, there's music supervisors who, of course, are responsible for placement in film and TV, who go and they're searching for music. So I am guessing that there would be a message to those types of people in the advertising world, in the film world, hey, we're open for business. Because probably there are some people out there who over the years have tried to get Bruce's music. As we know, he's been pretty particular, and it's probably more accessible for that kind of use now for a price.
Paging Lee Iacocca.
Exactly.
He was only 40 years too early.
Yeah, I don't know if that would happen today. I don't expect that they're going to be using Born in the USA for anything. And that was potentially exempt from what the New York Times article said at the time. But
well, and also look, I kind of doubt if Bruce himself would actually appear in the ad, which was, yeah, I think, part of GM's pitch.
Although he did appear in an ad, as we know. So
right. Yeah, a couple years ago, not in 1986.
No. So clearly things have changed on that front, I think, in a variety of ways. But let's talk about the selections because, yes, it's not really aimed at us, but it is an interesting thing to look at. There's 18 tracks on. We'll focus on the vinyl and the CD. I don't understand the digital track listing either. Like you were saying, I mean, Apple, Spotify, they all have best of Springsteen lists for their subscribers. Anyway, whatever on that. But as far as the vinyl and the CD, which is a physical release, 18 songs, there are 15, I think, 14 or 15 that you absolutely cannot quibble with at all in this context. There are a few that I would probably change. What about you?
Yeah, I was looking at it, and I've come up with four that I would swap out. It's kind of hard, obviously, to argue with all the ones that basically from 75 through, say, 94, up through Streets of Philadelphia. After that, you can kind of, I think there's The Ghost of Tom Joad, and I think he's very proud of that album, so he's going to want to include that. And that's probably one of the more accessible tracks on there. And then, as you pointed out, you have to have Secret Garden is basically his most recent success anywhere on top 40. But then after that, it's, I guess, outside The Rising, it's kind of like, okay, we can kind of do something different here. So what kind of changes would you make?
I wonder how involved he was. I'm guessing he's still involved, especially on something like this and presenting his best work, quote unquote. I would probably switch three or four. I definitely think Girls in Their Summer Clothes, and I understand, and that may be a sign of his influence because I think he likes that song.
it is a beautiful pop song. I think they did there what they were trying to do on Working on a Dream, and it was so much better in this song than anywhere on Working on a Dream.
I would personally have Radio Nowhere on there now. It was the lead single. It is a real sort of raucous song. I think it shows off the band. The more interesting, and we'll get back to the end, the more interesting portion to me is the beginning. Now, this is a best of, not greatest hits. So I take that in a sort of different context. I mean, greatest hits, clearly Grown Up is not a greatest hit. I mean, it was not a hit at all. But I can understand Grown Up being on there in this capacity because it does start his story, as we know from Broadway. And then Rosalita's sort of got to be on there as well. So I don't have any issue with those. It's strange that The River's not here, but I guess they didn't have room for it. And then at the end, Hello Sunshine, I think, should be the title track to Western Stars, and Letter to You should be Ghosts. That would be what I would say.
All right. Well, we agree on two of the four then. I think Growing Up should be Blinded by the Light, to be perfectly
honest. That's fair.
I think he should take it back. I mean, from Man for Man kind of thing. And, you know, he wrote the song. Let's give him full credit here. And then I would remove Summer Clothes, just like you would. But I would put on Long Walk Home.
That's a fair choice.
It's my favorite song off that album. So I think it should be on here. And again, like you, Hello Sunshine should be the title track, Western Stars, and Letter to You should be Ghosts. So it's really hard to quibble about too many of the others, that is for sure.
And Born to Run is, of course, basically an impossible one to choose from. They went with Born to Run and Thunder Road. You can't possibly argue with that.
No.
Obviously, and even on the extended version, which we're not really talking about, there's no Backstreets, there's no Jungle Land. Those are seminal songs, but I get it. If you got to distill it down, and they want to be representative of his entire career. So if they were just going to put the tracks from Born to Run on there, that wouldn't be a best of. That would be Born to Run.
That's true. I just did a Twitter thing the other night. Some people saying, what's your perfect album with the best opener and best closer? And I did the Born to Run album, of course, and got like 28,000 views. I was very, very surprised by that. And like 400 likes. I think it's my second biggest tweet ever.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to move on to High Hopes and finish up what we couldn't do the other day when you were sick. But before we do that, and we didn't really discuss this, but I think it will be fun, let's quickly touch on the 2024 tour. Over on Brave Talk, which is our message board for our Patreon subscribers, we've been discussing some over-unders and what might happen on the tour. I'm curious to hear what you think. Will there be more than one song in Phoenix that wasn't played in 2023? Do you even think there will be one song in Phoenix that wasn't played in 2023?
Wait, here's kind of my question on that. Do you mean one song that wasn't played regularly?
Song that was not played at all,
at
basically.
All. Yeah. Yeah, one. Maybe one. Definitely taking the under on that one. I think you put it at 1.5, and I'm
going to 1.5 was how I set it on our board.
It seems to me,
I think that maybe we'll get one or two songs that weren't played last year. I mean, the other interesting question is going to be as the tour approaches, because I also counted today. I shouldn't say we saw because you saw different songs than I did. I saw 9 songs at MetLife that I had not seen previously in 2023. Now, Lonesome Day was played 3 nights in a row to open the MetLife shows, followed by Night. It wasn't really played anywhere else except for Foxborough. I wonder if he'll stick with Lonesome Day or if he'll go back to No Surrender.
These are all questions we're not going to know until the lights go out and Bruce counts into whatever song he's going to play. I mean, it is a good question whether it would be Lonesome or go back to No Surrender or something else. That's the kind of thing where, it'll work. That would work for me. I like that opening.
Which one?
Lonesome Day Night.
Yeah, I thought that worked extremely well. I prefer Lonesome Day as an opener to No Surrender myself. And then I think we both expect Ghost was, of course, not played at the final MetLife show, but I am sure we'll be back for this leg, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'd be disappointed if it's not played.
Of
all the new material, and there's not a lot of it in a show, that's definitely my favorite and definitely the one that I would miss the most if it got dropped on a permanent basis.
Now, the other major question I think people are going to be looking at, the two nightstands, which there are not many. The second night in San Francisco, how many songs do you think will be different potentially from night one?
Well, what was it from first night at UBS in Belmont to night two?
I think
it's going to be okay. Well, there you go. There's your answer.
Well, look, in Copenhagen, I think it was at least five, maybe six between nights one and two. I will be disappointed if in the two night stands he only changes three songs.
It would be disappointing, but expectations and hopes need to be adjusted based on last year. You said that to me earlier today.
Yeah, I agree fully.
And I'm just going to throw it right back at you.
The thing is, he has such a wealth of material. Even if we look at the best of, you know what's interesting about the best of being released, especially before they go to Europe? Most of these songs are not going to be played. You know, most people who put out a best of before they go on tour, the songs would be played.
Well, see, Rosie, Born to Run, Thunder Road, Badlands, Dancing in the Dark, The Rising.
Right, but you're not going to likely see Hungry Heart. Maybe that will be added in this year. Born in the USA, well, you're not going to see in the United States, almost certainly. Brilliant Disguise and Human Touch, probably there's only a hope if Patty is there. Streets of Philadelphia, right. Forget about until we at least get the Philly. Jode, you never know. Secret Garden, forget about.
Well, for Joe, just like if Morella's there, then the odds of that one go up tremendously.
Yeah. Well, that could actually happen in L.A., so.
Right. Okay. All right.
We're not going to see Hello Sunshine. I know that.
That's for sure. You're not going to see anything from that album ever.
Well, I am holding out hope. I know I'm being silly here, but obviously the Western Stars album takes place, much of it, in the Los Angeles area, especially the title track. I know he's not really doing that on this tour, but man, would it be cool if he played Western Stars in LA.
Well, I guess he got my hopes up when he did Dirty Water in Boston. So maybe he could stick with some more thematically appropriate geographical songs. But that one he's done many times, so I'm not holding out hope for Western Stars in the West.
No, I think the one that'll probably happen, if it's going to be like Dirty Water, will be Viva Las Vegas in Vegas.
Yes.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
All right, let's move back to the High Hopes tour. And we're going to wrap this up quickly. We, of course, covered a bunch of shows with Kirk in the last episode, and we appreciate the excellent feedback we got on that one. You were in which places besides the shows we talked about last week?
Actually, just two. I was in Brooklyn for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions of the E Street Band, and then at the next show down in Virginia Beach on April 12th.
Right. And what did you think about the induction ceremony?
I didn't realize that every member of the band was going to speak before we walked in. And there were a lot of people in that band, and certainly the alumni of Vinnie Lopez, Davey Sanchez. And I guess that's the only two. Oh, Boone Carter was there, right?
Yeah, he was there.
And so there was a lot of talking going on, and Davey Sanchez took a little bit more time than the rest of the band. So it kind of went on for a while. And then they played three songs, E Street Shuffle, The River, and Kitty's Back. And I got to be honest here. E Street Shuffle I get, Kitty's Back I get. They really did flex out there. They brought the horns, because obviously the horns were on tour with them. But I'm still perplexed by The River. That one just didn't seem to work in, or I didn't see why it fit. Do you have any insight on that one?
I think it's a song perhaps he feels shows off the band nicely in the coda, would be my guess.
Okay. I was thinking something more maybe from the 75 to 84 era, you know, the classic E Street Band time, but I guess the E Street Shuffle and Kitty's Back really did let everybody play, including both drummers, Vinny and Max.
Well, the other thing that dawns on me, I would think the Promised Land would be fitting for that moment, but he did play Promised Land at his own induction. I don't know if that factored into it.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it was fun. It was a fun night. Love seeing those guys really get their due. Obviously, a lot of people thought they should have been inducted in 99. I think Steve Van Zandt had this, the legendary quote, like, you know, but Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, that's the legend. And Bruce did admit that he had some reservations about going in with them at the time. He did kind of accept blame for his ego playing too big of a role in that. But they finally got their due. It's too bad that Clarence and Danny weren't alive to see that.
Yeah, Bruce Bass, of course, always having the best info, says that Bruce gave a 16-minute speech, and it was a very touching and honest speech. He's so good in those circumstances. That was followed by 35 minutes of E Street Band speeches, and while I think we all are happy they got their due, I don't know that the other inductees shared the enthusiasm for the 50-minute E Street Band segment, pushing them much later into the evening. But
yeah, it was a long night, and it was also the year that Nirvana got inducted, and that was actually pretty cool seeing them. Kurt Cobain is no longer with us, but hearing Joan Jett do Smells Like Teen Spirit, that was actually pretty intense. And I think actually I felt more excitement for that moment than I did during the E Street performances, to be perfectly honest.
Now, from there, you went to Virginia Beach. We're going to highlight mainly the shows that we feel had important stuff. We're not going to go through. We already spent 50 minutes with Kirk. We're not going to go through show by show, especially the shows we didn't see, but we're going to highlight the important stuff. What did you feel about the Virginia Beach show, which had a lot of cool stuff in it?
Oh, I love that show. I thought it was a tremendously fun show. As we talked about, there's no narrative. There was no narrative on this tour. They were just kind of all over the place. And he opened with a song called May I, which honestly, I never heard before, and the only stuff I know about this song is what's written on Bruce Bass, that it came out in 1969, and it was done by a band called Bill Deal and the Rondells, and that's all I know, and it was a fun song, I gotta say that, a little weird to hear him open a show that with a song I never heard before, but it's always kind of a cool moment, as we talked about the Akron 96 archive release. But definitely not one that I was anticipating. And I guess it has kind of a beach vibe, and it is Virginia Beach. So it worked well. And then going into Mary's Place, I thought that was a good 1-2 punch.
Yeah, and this show also had three tour premieres in a row. Talk to Me, Seaside Bar Song, and Jersey Girl, which I think those do have that sort of, well, certainly Seaside Bar Song has a beach vibe. And so that goes to what you're talking about. How was that sequence?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Talk to Me. Patty was at the show, and so he talked about how the whole not talking, and now you talk, and then you don't talk, and then he talked about dodging fashion magazines and hair dryers. So I hope he was making that up with regards to domestic relations with Miss Patty. But it was very funny in the moment. And The Wall made its tour debut at this show, and I think a big part of the reason why is because of the big military presence down there in Virginia Beach and Newport.
Yeah, and it seems like he hadn't thought of, or he didn't want to do the Born in the USA combo yet, because The Wall went into Born to Run. We talked about last week how incredibly effective that double shot of The Wall into Born in the USA was. It was incredibly compelling. So you didn't get that here, but it still seems like a high octane bunch of encores.
Oh yeah, it was great, and Thunder Road was full band, and so as you said, that always means there's a little more energy in the crowd that night.
Now, what's the next show we should talk about? I think Nashville, which had that double shot of Burning Love into Satisfaction.
I would think so, but you want to talk about the Harry's Place getting soundchecked in Columbus, but fortunately never played.
Oh, I did not even. Oh, I see that now that you're mentioning it. I actually never noticed that. Yeah, I don't know if anyone needs to hear that.
No, not at all. But yeah, Nashville looked like a good show with those two covers right there, and here talking about The Wall into Born in the USA. Here he does the Point Blank makes his tour debut between the two. I don't know if that more emphasizes the meaning behind Born in the USA or not, but it's definitely a powerful segue between Point Blank and into USA.
It's a bleak segment in many ways, but to use the same word again, really, really compelling. And I actually enjoy listening to that. Of course, as I mentioned in the wrap-up last week after we were done with Kirk, all these shows were released. This was the first time they ever did official bootlegs. They're not as high quality as the ones that would follow later, but still make for a decent listen every now and then.
Oh, yeah. There's a crunchiness to these recordings that I really like. I mean, I know that the ones from the River Tour and the 23 Tour, perfect sound, basically, and you can hear every instrument, but I kind of feel like the crunchiness and the kind of more rawness of the 2014 recordings, they make a good bridge between the audience recordings from pre-2014 and what would come later.
Now, next, well, we should mention American Beauty came out on April 18th. Now, that had very minimal impact on the tour because, of course, none of it ever got played. But it's worth noting, and they did sound check American Beauty at the next show, Charlotte. It's unclear if that was to actually potentially play in the show or if they were working on it because they did shoot a video. Do you know?
I do not know, and I would guess that it was more for the video shoot than to actually play it. But I would love to be wrong, but of course, I don't think he's ever going to play that one live ever. So the point is moot, as they say. But I think the big thing about Charlotte is the opening Iceman, and only the second time it's ever been played, and first time with the band. And I think it was done a few years later in Paris, but I can't imagine what a holy crap moment that must have been for people who actually knew the song and were probably just blown away by the fact that he opened with it.
Yeah, this is a really wild show. This is like what we were talking about last week with Kirk. Now, From Small Things, of course, is a Bruce original, although made famous by Dave Edmonds. But Louie Louie, Mustang Sally, Brown Eyed Girl, all in the same show. You know, again, it's like, I mean, it's cool. It's ultra cool. But also, it's a bit random, no?
Yeah, it's kind of a throwback to that 2009 Stump the Band. Of course, these three songs, I'm sure the E Street Band could play in their sleep. But it was a lot of covers. And he did reference that the Darlington Raceway was just a little bit not too far from Charlotte. And he talked about that as the intro to Mustang Sally. He also talked about how next year would be the year following. I guess that would be 2015. 50 years playing that guitar. So that was kind of a fun moment right there.
Now, there's something else that's notable about the show, the encores. And this is, I don't think this has happened too many times. Darkness was played in the encores to open the encores. Now, here is a thematic sequence. Darkness followed by The Wall, followed by Born in the USA. I don't know what got into him that had him putting in songs to the encores that are certainly rarely there, like Darkness and Point Blank, but it seemed like as random as the main set was some of these nights, that he really had a dark theme sort of in mind, which obviously is very pointed with Darkness, that he wanted to get off his chest in these encores. What do you make of that?
I don't know. That's a good question. For a show that is so fun, as you were saying, Louie Louie, Mustang Sally, Brown Eyed Girl, and of course, Out in the Street, Hungry Heart, and Cadillac Ranch. Those are all very fun songs. And then to open the encores with some very dark stuff, I guess he felt he needed it. Maybe the shows were just too upbeat, so he had to do something. And of course, the darker the low moments or the intense moments, the bigger the release. So I think once he had Born to Run, I'm sure that building exploded.
And the other thing, I'm looking at the set list now, the final song of the main set was Light of Day. So that's actually, I don't know what to make of that. That Light of Day, they didn't leave the stage at this point, but they end the main set and then he counts into Darkness.
Well, they took a bit of a break. They came out to the lip of the stage, as they always do, and took their bows. So it wasn't that different. I always liked the fact that a lot of these shows ended with Rising into Land of Hope and Dreams. I love that combination. And the throw in Light of Day is it's definitely a good change up. And he did it a few times, including in Albany.
I get what you're saying, but of course, the main theme of Light of Day is we're just around the corner to the light of day. And then the next song is Darkness on the Edge of Town. It seems incongruous to the point of being intentional, no?
Maybe. I that's a good question. And that's a very good question. I don't know.
I mean, that's not a pairing that has ever been performed anything like it before.
I don't think so. Is the handwritten set list or anything available for this? So
that's actually a good question. Let's check here.
Yeah, the Rising into Badlands ends the main set. So Darkness was definitely inaudible, as was Light of Day.
That just it's so funny because it does bring up, like we were talking about over the last couple of episodes, how does he come up with this stuff? You almost wonder if that happened accidentally since they were audibles or if he thought it through. We'll never know, but it is, I find that pretty fascinating.
It is interesting. Maybe he was just thinking, I'm going to make a whole 180 here and go from Light of Day to Darkness on the Edge of Town.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.
And we talked about Pittsburgh and Raleigh with Kirk on the last episode. So looking at the Atlanta show on April 26th, you got to wonder if work on the River Box was happening at that time. He did 7 songs off the river plus Traps. And he even mentioned, I think he even said the river at one point. So it was definitely on his mind.
Yeah. And of course this was before 2016 when he did the full album performances again. You may be right. He may have been working on the box. It seemed like from night to night, there was just, and of course, as we talked about, this was an incredibly wild leg as it pertained to the set list. And it just seemed like from night to night, you never knew what you were going to get. And here in Atlanta, it was the river.
And it's what's really interesting to me is that he did 7 songs off the river, and then but then none of them are Hungry Heart. So that's kind of a surprise in looking at the set list. And I think the Independence Day on solo piano, that was definitely a pretty cool moment. And as well as Drive All Night to open the encores, I think a lot of people were just blown away by that.
Yeah, and they moved on to Sunrise. We talked about it a little the last time. I was not huge on Clampdown. I certainly wasn't huge on it as an opener. There was some other sections of this show that some interesting stuff. Now, I Want to Marry You played, which, of course, is pretty rare. Then the premiere of Linda Let Me Be the One, you got Hearts of Stone in there. So this is another show. I mean, they were really drawing on the entirety of his career.
Yeah, Linda Let Me Be the One, I just can't believe it made its live debut. That was played live at all. and they did nail it. They messed it up, had to restart it at one point. But I think I've said it before, I'd rather hear a sloppy Linda Let Me Be the One than a note perfect out in the street. And I think you were kind of hinting at the Southside double shot, Hearts of Stone, yeah, and to Talk to Me. That must have been a damn cool moment. Obviously, well, we saw it later on in Mohegan, but to hear the E Street debut of Hearts of Stone, that would have been pretty damn cool.
Yeah, and in this show, he did do Highway to Hell, which I think we like. And The Wall, interestingly, was played after Shout and before Thunder Road. That was a full band, Thunder Road, so that makes sense. Sort of a weird place to put The Wall there. There's no set list for this show, so we don't know what was planned and what was inaudible there. But that also seems sort of, to follow the Shout with The Wall seems kind of strange.
Well, the previous year, he had done acoustic songs after Shout,
yes,
to close the show. So I easily could fall into that kind of category now. Going back to a full band Thunder Road's a little weird, but it's, I'm sure it was still a beautiful performance. And one more song I do want to highlight from Sunrise is Save My Love. During the intro to the song, he talks about how one of the highlights of his life was hearing Spirit in the Night being played on somebody's car radio, and he was able to hear it. They were up in Rhode Island for a show at some college, and he talked about it was just one of the top five moments of his life, and that's got to be a pretty cool moment for him.
Yes, and from there, they moved on to Tampa. Now, this show opened with Joe Hill. I think this is another one. We talked about the influence of Morello. It was May Day. I think it's likely that Morello had an impact on that being the selection to open the show. And then the other thing in this show was that they were getting ready, as he said, for Jazz Fest, which brought in the debut of Jesse James. No further commentary on that. And also, Oh Mary, Don't You Weep, which I can tolerate a lot more.
They also did Pay Me My Money Down, so don't forget about that one. Going back to the opener of Joe Hill, I don't think this one worked well at all. I can imagine that people there were wondering what this song was. It is a cool moment when Bruce comes out and does something you've never heard before to open a show, but I think this one, I don't think it really worked. And then going into Clampdown, which we've already discussed, I think he really needed to get the crowd back, and he definitely was able to do that with Badlands Ties and Out in the Street right in a row. But I think he put himself in quite a bit of a hole there.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because, as you just noted, you open with two songs that the audience is not expecting. They're probably not all that thrilled with it. And then also you've got the Seeger Sessions material in the show. Now, also he did, and this is cool, although I don't know that this is really rallying an amphitheater crowd either, they did a very rare performance of Brothers Under the Bridge.
You mean like the second performance ever with the E Street Band?
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty rare.
That would make it very rare, no?
Yeah, that would. And he did dig a little bit deeper here. Besides Brothers, you had From Small Things and We Are Alive to open the encores. So they really, I mean, this one's almost kind of a split personality kind of show and set list.
Yeah, and you can see in the middle, certainly there was a momentum section, Wrecking Ball, Night, My Love, Gloria, No Surrender, Bobby Jean. So there I think the recording shows that was a very high energy portion of the show. But yeah, it does sort of veer around. And I don't know, in Tampa, if people, it's sort of like a rehearsal for Jazz Fest. I wonder how that went over.
That's a good question. I can't imagine. I imagine that a lot of people share your feelings on some of that Seeger Sessions material. So whether he was preparing for Jazz Fest or what, that kind of thing, I'm sure, did not go over well with a portion of the audience.
Well, all right, let's talk about Jazz Fest. This is the third time that Bruce will be appearing there, the second time with the E Streeters. The first time, of course, was in 2012, and that's a really excellent show to listen to, in my opinion. Now, we say this all the time in regards to potential releases from that year, because there are so many, but it was really a high-quality show, and he did a really nice version of Rocky Ground combined with When the Saints Go Marching In. That was gorgeous. So here, this one's a little bit different. It's a shorter set. I think they had a limited amount of time, and there's a lot of guests involved. Ricky Lee Jones, John Fogerty, who's always welcome, Fogerty's kids who play with him in his band. But I think set-wise, it's certainly not as interesting as some of the shows we've been talking about previously.
Well, you're right. There's not a lot of totally out of left field stuff unless you consider How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live and When the Saints Go Marching In. So beyond that, it was pretty much what he had done, say, since 2012 on the road. And it's I think the guest spots of John Fogerty on Green River and Proud Mary are definitely my highlights. And I'm still wondering why Ricky Lee Jones was on stage for what seems like half the show.
That is curious. I don't know. Certainly, listening to it, there's nowhere near the level, I think, that they hit in 2012. But you could probably say that as wild as the set lists were in 2014, I think we both agree the 2012 touring year was far superior to the 2014 touring year, right?
For the most part, yeah. There was a certain wildness to 2014 that was not there in 2012. And of course, 2012 was a little bit more focused on the Rocky Mall material, which yeah, I really like, especially the whole Rocky Ground and We Are Alive combination. I just love those songs in the encores. But anyway, let's go back to 2014.
Well, Bruce made a guest appearance that night after Jazz Fest with Dr. John, Right Place, Wrong Time, which must have been fun for the people there. And then they moved on to Houston. This is another wild one featuring two very rarely played songs, at least with the band. One of which, One Step Up, had not been played with the band since 1988, right?
That is correct. That is correct. And he had kind of a Tunnel of Love Express Tour thing going on between Adam Raise the Cane and To She's the One, and then One Step Up. So that's kind of a cool thing to listen to. And I do believe One Step Up was a signed request, and I think the person actually mentioned the fact that it hadn't been played since June of 1988, and so it was time. It caught his eye, so maybe we should bring up signs for and put the date the last time that song was played.
The other rarity in this show was All or Nothing. That's a fun one, and the band does a good job on that. That's only been played, what is that, two or three times?
With the E Street Band?
Yeah.
I can only think of this one as the second. The other one was in 2009.
Okay.
But yeah, it's funny to hear him play it, because it says, feel free to clap along at any time. Because he kind of knows it's not the most the love song, but he does call it a lost masterpiece at the end of it. It is a very fun song. It's not exactly Jungle Land, but it's fun in its own right.
And Joe Ely made an appearance in the encores, Great Balls of Fire and Lucille. He's always welcome. He's a good guest.
Yes, he is. And they had done All Just to Get to You a couple of times previously. I know in 2000 and I think in 2008. So they change it up a little bit, doing a couple of classic rock covers, and that's a really fun combo to listen to as well.
Now, the last show we have to talk about falls between Albany and Mohegan. There was a show in Hershey, which we didn't touch on last week. This show is really, I think, most interesting because it helped set up, unfortunately, what happened Mohegan Night 2. They played in Albany on May 13th. Then they went to Hershey on May 14th. He took 2 days off, and then he played on back-to-back days again. So that was 4 shows in 6 nights when he was 64 years old. Now, he was in absolutely incredible shape, but I think it was just too much for him.
I also think it has something to do with the fact that it was at the end of the leg. And
yes, for sure.
And so any wear and tear on his body that had occurred over the previous couple of months, 3 months, it takes its toll. It's kind of like a baseball player in August and September trying to get through to the end of the season with all the little nicks and injuries you have. And so I think that played a role too. I think if he had opened with this kind of schedule, 4 shows in 6 days, and I think it would have been in better shape, but to end it, I think was definitely tough on his body.
Yes, 100%. And also, I believe there was an incident this night. He went crowd surfing and it didn't go all that well. I don't know. There was always speculation. Did he get hurt because he sort of was dropped by the crowd? Whatever happened, it was a lot for him. And, you know, as I said, he was in the shape that this man was in at his age of 64. I've talked about this before, going back even a couple of years earlier to Paris and what was going on in that venue. It was really, you know, we use the term freak of nature, and it is the truth. But I do think here he was overtaxed, and that helped set up what happened at Mohegan.
Let's talk about a couple of songs here at Hershey, though.
Yeah.
Nice little combination of Candy's Room into Roulette, kind of reminiscent of the second night at Shea in 2003.
Yeah. That is always a great pairing. Be True was a tour premiere, but I want to talk about a pairing that's not as predictable. The never before seen and likely never seen again. Surprise, surprise, followed by The Wall.
I don't think it's that big of a deal here.
I don't think it's a big deal. I just think it's I think it's kind of funny in a way.
Well, it is kind of a whiplash, and I think it was a request by somebody whose birthday was around that time. So it's definitely his birthday song. And he did it solo acoustic. It wasn't like the band was there and then they it went right into the wall, which that would be like hitting the wall, so to speak. But it was just kind of a fun little thing. And then he got serious, even though he didn't do Born in the USA after The Wall, he did Born to Run.
Yeah, curious when he left that Born in the USA. Fortunately, we had seen that pairing in Albany, which remains the last time that pairing has been played to date. That was, and as we were talking about last week, the Albany show was pretty spectacular. How did that compare? You did say you thought that the Albany show was the best show you saw in 2014, so that would be better than Virginia Beach, right?
Yes, but not too far ahead of Virginia Beach. I thought Virginia Beach was a tremendous show. It had enough rarities and it had a nice feel to it overall, whereas some of the songs and performances of Mohegan just didn't quite get to where we wanted it to be.
Right. Now, before we sign off for the evening, do you have any thoughts on the mystery, which I touched on, we were going to talk about, but you were sick, the missing Mohegan 2 bootleg, official bootleg?
Any feelings on why it was pulled? His voice wasn't up to par. It was released at first through Live Nation, which was how they were distributing those 2014 shows. And then when they went up on Nugs in November of that year, it mysteriously wasn't there. So it is out there, and I don't know why they pulled it. I mean, obviously his voice was shot, but I didn't think it was shot that badly. And I love listening to some of that stuff. Seven Angels is, I think, I just love listening to that, as well as Roll of the Dice and that Frankie. And it's just a disappointment, but it is what it is, as they say.
Yeah, I believe I said the same thing last week. So, all right, that wraps up our coverage of the High Hopes Tour. Thanks again to Kirk for recommending that as a topic. We had fun with it. After the tour ended, we're not going to discuss it now. Bruce did do two shows with Grushecki in Pittsburgh that obviously were not a part of the High Hopes Tour. We'll get to the Grushecki shows, I'm sure, at some point. And other than that, we're looking forward to talking. There should be an archive release on Friday. This episode may not come out till Friday, so you may be listening to a new archive right after you're listening to us, or vice versa. We're going to do a review of the archive, which we're looking forward to. And then from there, we're going to get back into tour coverage. And I mentioned we're going to do a 25th anniversary look of the reunion era starting on March 18th, 1999. That's going to probably get slightly moved now because of the archive coming out and because of the tour coverage. So that'll be either later in March or early in April, most likely.
It's going to be wild looking back at 25 years of the reunion era. I've been thinking, though, maybe the reunion era really started at with the release of Tracks, but it really kicked off officially March 18th, 1999.
Oh, yeah. I would point to that date for sure. I mean, you know, I think, and we'll talk about this next time, but I think emotionally for us, it sort of started maybe at the Pat King benefit even, but let's save that for the actual episode.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, I'm going to wrap things up then. None But the Brave is a presentation of Evergreen Podcast produced by Bull Market Entertainment. Check out our Patreon offerings, patreon.com/MBTB podcast. And on Twitter, we're at MBTB podcast.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flim McClain saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.